Okay, we are getting started. Hi everyone, my name is Dina Damak. I'm an assistant professor at the Wheel City of Science and Technology. Today we are very fortunate to have four distinguished speakers to discuss their path to circuit design. Our first speaker is Dr. Alvin Luk. He is a technical director at NXP Semiconductor in San Diego. He has worked on every CMOS node from 250 nanometer to 2 nanometer at AgileNet, AMD, Qualcomm, TSMC, and PhD from Stanford. And our next speaker would be Dr. Andrea Caselin. She started electrical engineering studies at the Polytechnic Institute of Bucharest, Romania, and graduated with a Master of Science from the Institute of Superior in France. And she received a PhD from the Université de Lille, France as well. And she is currently a technology R&D fellow at ST Microelectronics France. She is a co-editor of a book on fully depleted SOI. Our following speaker would be Dr. Janan Dash-Dufrin. She is an assistant professor in the program in Media Arts and Science at MIT, where she leads the Conformal Decoders Research Group. She has been selected as one of the top 35 under 35 by MIT and Forbes list, and she's on Forbes list 30 under 30, and she has a PhD from IUC. And last but not least is Dr. Brian Floyd, and he is a professor at North Carolina State University, and he has been there since January 2010. His research interests include RF and millimeter wave circuits and systems for wireless communication, imaging, and radar applications. And prior to joining North Carolina State, he has been with IBM, and he has worked on some of the world's first 60 gigahertz transceivers in silicon. Thank you very much for being with us today. Our panelists will start first by going through their slides, and then we will open the Q&A with the audience. The audience can raise their questions using the chat, and I will go through them. So Dr. Alvin Luk, you can go ahead with your slide.
Thanks very much for this incredible opportunity. So I was just going to just spend a few minutes to talk a little bit about my path to circuit design and then some pointers and so forth. So I was born in Malaysia. I'm ethnically Chinese. I grew up in Vancouver, Canada. But then after doing my undergrad, I moved to the US, had a couple of years, short stint living in Singapore. So I graduated from UBC, master's PhD from Stanford, very, very touched and very inspired by Sujay's presentation. In fact, actually, when I was a student, I remember gowning up in the same room to go into the clean room with Sujay. So it's just really cool to see, you know, how well she's done and everything, obviously, very deservingly. So one thing I did want to mention, I was very fortunate to get involved in lots of internships. And I cannot emphasize enough, if you have not done an internship, this is something that's really, really important. For a dumb Canuck like myself, it wasn't until I had an internship in Japan where I actually realized that Stanford was on the West Coast, not the East Coast. So I've spent quite a few years in industry. I actually started kind of a non-traditional path. I started in process technology and integration. So I worked in a few years doing semiconductor physics, process development, bring up things like that in a fab startup. And after several years, I just came to realize I'm just tired of just the pace of, you know, the 3 a.m. phone calls and so forth. But I decided to go into circuit design and, very fortunately been able to, you know, ride from node to node, down to even nano sheets when I spent some time at TSMC, lived in many places, which has been a lot of fun. Now, one thing that started me into my involvement in solid state circuits was living in Colorado, where I realized everyone would rather, spend time organizing bike rides than, you know, actually thinking about technical things. And so, coming from the Bay Area, this is something I was very much used to, the kind of technical vitality, which didn't exist. And so that's kind of how I got started as a chapter officer. And then going on and taking care of more and more responsibilities. And it's been a lot of fun. Anyways, enough about me. Next slide, please. Some pointers about things that have helped my career. you know, this is mentioned multiple times already, and I cannot emphasize this enough. Getting mentored is really, really key. Okay. I mean, mentors just help develop you in so many ways, right? Not just the nerdy stuff, but also, you know, everything to coping with life. I've really benefited tremendously from mentors. You know, I usually have a slide that shows, like, you know, a list of like almost 100 mentors. I keep as kind of like a tribute to my mentors. But, you know, equally important is to pay it forward, right? Actually, one of my life mentors, Ray Stephanie, told me one time, you know, he'll write reference letters for me, you know, when it's time to write promo letters, when he's convinced that you make other people better. And that's something that has been very near and dear advice to me. You know, when you help others, you know, you build trusted relationships, you build your credibility. The other thing also is that, you know, has really benefited me career-wise is having a broad and deep knowledge of multiple disciplines. In my case, it's both IC technology as well as circuit design. I took circuit design classes back in college and grad school thinking, you know, maybe I might actually find some use to it one day. Not that I actually realized that this would be something I would be doing for my living. Okay. Another thing that has, you know, repeatedly been mentioned is, you know, being curious, being inquisitive, and continuously learn. Okay. And I find a lot more fascination, not just with the technical stuff, but also the ability to communicate, right? I mean, our past speakers, they're clearly very articulate speakers, and the ability to communicate, to get your point across, you know, that in itself, you know, has builds charisma, your ability to connect with people, okay? And certainly all the stuff that IEEE has done, in particular for me with solid state circuits, has been really instrumental. And last and certainly not least is networking. Okay, and building relationships. You know, I lost my first job, I think like 4 months after I graduated from my PhD because HP decided to spin Agilent off. And so early on in my career, I've come to learn that job security really doesn't exist. And, you know, when you have a good network of friends and colleagues and so forth, that really helps. Next slide, please. So a potpourri of advice I want to go through. Hopefully I'll, you know, get through this in a few minutes. So, you know, you have mentors. Definitely you want to cultivate your mentors from your mentors. But, you know, at the end of the day, you do need to take care of your own career. That's very important. Tip number two, accept change in our industry as the norm. And, you know, the best remedy to deal with the change is to never stop learning. Number three, always stay connected with the fundamentals, not with the buzzwords. Okay. What I'm learning and humbly accepting is my memory has gotten a lot worse over the last, you know, maybe 5-10 years. And just staying connected, stubbornly connected to my fundamentals have been extremely helpful. Number four, just as Sujay pointed out, understanding your personal strengths and your shortcomings is important. I have learned that the only way to really figure them out is to try different things. You see how you react to the situation and how you deal with it. Number five, I find work hard, you know, but if you want to work hard, which is not obviously an important thing that you know, you need to do just to even get in the game, you want to do it for yourself and not for others. I remembered a tough love message I got from my advisor. He basically told me, no one gives a, you know, sugar honey iced tea how hard you work. And that, you know, that's something that stayed with me. Next comment about, you know, work quality and satisfaction and compensation. I certainly learned that they're not necessarily correlated. So you have to decide the balance that works best work for you. Another one, a little bit, I guess, non-technical is related to financial stress. Okay. I find that, you know, you have really little to no control over financial stress. So avoid getting into it, okay? So if you cannot afford that fancy house or that fancy car, then you shouldn't be even getting yourself into that mess. I've also learned that school is artificially objective, but the real world is not. And also next point about investing in understanding people because the world has politics and you have to learn how to navigate around it. We've talked about investing in networking and building relationships, because over time, I've certainly found that who you know becomes increasingly more important than what you know. Sujay made a point about relationships, choosing your partner, so forth. Turns out that my wife is also doing the very same type of thing that I'm in. I have certainly learned, sometimes harder than I wished, keeping a healthy distance from your spouse at work, if you're in the same career, can be very helpful. The thing about, gets back to work-life balance. You know, everyone talks about aspiring to a good work-life balance. The very fact that we're all here probably means that this is something we struggle with, because we take our work seriously. Accept it as lifelong learning and not something that you have solved. Okay. And second to last note, the thing about personal integrity, it really matters. So please do not compromise it. Okay. So for instance, one thing I see with some new graduates, they promise, they sign that they've accepted a job offer, but they don't show up. That is not cool. Okay. That's just, you do what you say and say what you do. And pay it forward. Mentoring gets back to mentoring. It's a two-way street. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alvin. Our next speaker is Dr. Andrea Castellan from France.
Thank you for having me here. So I'm very honored to be on this panel. I am very honored to speak after Alvin. Alvin is one of my coolest acquaintances in this microelectronics world. He's just a buddy that will write to you on the 1st of January, hey, just wishing you a happy new year. And I will tell you a secret, he has a very cool addresses of udon at Waikiki. So for next time we go to Hawaii. Okay, so a few words about myself. So I have been born in Romania, in Bucharest, and I lived there for the first 20 years of my life. When I was a teen, I loved to solve engineering problems. I loved aerobics dancing, but I don't put you any pictures of that. And I loved and I continue loving high mountain hiking and skiing. I am born in a family of electrical engineers. I am a third generation of electrical engineers. I learned at that time, the bipolar was the hype, so I learned it from my dad. And I learned to debate on microelectronics with my mom, who has been a professor of electrotechnics. And our debate, she was asking me, I don't understand how you can make work a transistor with so low currents, because she was doing hundreds of amperes, okay? My dream when I was 20 was first to live in a chalet in the mountains, and I do, I'm there, as you can see there, a picture from my window. My dream was to study MOS transistor noise, and I did it, and I did much more than that. And my dream was also to have at least a daughter, and we have been gifted, and I have a daughter and a son, and you can see their picture there as well. So if you can click for the next one, please, Dina. Okay, so regarding my career path, so Dina has said a lot of me in the introduction. I just would like to add a few points here. So I have been awarded 2 years ago a honorary doctorate from the University of Lund. And it's maybe too small, you cannot see, but these sweet guys, they are very attentionate to gender balance. And in fact, the ceremony, which was very virtual, is in Latin and is like that since 400 years. And they decline into feminine. So I have been greeted by Salve Femina Doctissima. Okay. And then my name was translated in Latin. And I found that very cool. So I'm with ST Microelectronics in Crolles in France since almost 25 years. And I've had a lot of positions in advanced R&D on design topics. I'm now a technology R&D fellow. I worked on many topics on RF, millimeter waves, and terahertz design. And also I work a lot on FDSOI CMOS technology, like did my friend Alvin a few years ago also. And I work in a program where I can supervise in industry students together with academia, and through this program, I've been supervising more than 35 PhD students over the years. I had a lot of positions on IEEE matters in the conferences you can see there, and I've been the TPC chair of ESSERC 2020 and 2021. If you can click for the next, please. So here are some dots of some career advices that I would like to give you in the opening of this panel. So learn something new every day in your life. So, I mean, it's cool. We have a job where we can do learning every day. And by the way, this our field, it's electrical engineering, is a very fast growing field. And we face a lot of challenges, but we are also having a lot of opportunities to make the world a better place to live, and we have to take it. And for where to find a working place, so think if it's sustainable, think if it cares about the humans that work in, and also the all humans and the planet well-being. And then as a personal advice, so surround yourself with advisors, with mentors and coaches, and both women and men, and learn from all of them, and I mean, get accompanied by them. Recognize your errors and learn from them. That's a very important point. It's that learning all through your life. Define your own career path, but don't be blunt on it, and allow yourself to do on-the-fly adjustment. So that's very okay. So when I started working, on my mind was a lady has to work twice as a gentleman to be equally recognized. This is still valid, but we can all make it so that it fades, and that at a certain point this will go away. And don't forget to live a pleasant life next to good people, and to cultivate your hobbies. And my last point, so a bullet point, so create and raise a family around you. Meet like your blood family, like your adoptive family, like your work family. Share your knowledge and give more than you have received. And the last but not least, enjoy what you're doing. And just the next click. So I wanted to share with you. So the motto of the company I'm working in, ST Microelectronics, is life.augmented. And we say everywhere microelectronics make a positive contribution to people's life, ST so is there. And I'm cool. I'm very glad to work in a company that says this. And this is very cool. Thank you very much. I give the word to the next speaker.
Thank you very much, Dr. Andrea. Our next speaker is Professor Janan Dajdur, Assistant Professor at ST.
Great. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for this. Maybe, Dina, you can start the video from start and I will speak over it. It's a great pleasure to be on this panel all together. My name is Janan, and Dina, you can just stop it. stop the video, please. So my name is Janan. I'm a faculty at MIT, and I direct a research group called Conformable Decoders, and we develop mechanically adaptive electromechanical systems in the forms of sensors, actuators, transducers, and mechanical energy harvesters. And now, Dina, if you don't mind, you can click the video. Thank you. And we believe that a human body is magical. Eyes, nose, heart, skin, they all talk to us, and we create conformable electronic devices with microelectronic components, and we can roll the device like a carpet and place in a dissolvable gelatin capsule, and you can even take them orally like a fantastic voyage. It can travel from all the way from your mouth well to the other end without any invasive prodding required. And when the dissolvable capsule opens, it can stick on the stomach lining and tell like a Fitbit how much you eat. Not only that, we can laminate these devices on beating organs, internal organs like heart. And we can do 8-inch wafer processing. And through smart device designs and microfabrication techniques, we can make these devices wearable on your skin. You can laminate it, delaminate it on your face. It can conform all the wrinkles on your face, and with a simple smile or twitch, you can compose thousands of messages or send a personalized message for nonverbal communications, especially for patients with neurodegenerative disorders or speech disorders. We can even camouflage these devices with makeup products so nobody can understand you have them on your skin. And also we can integrate these devices on a textile forms and make them even washable for daily use. And also these devices can be three-dimensional and placed in a large or small animal models and change the behavior activity within pinpoint accuracy and subseconds. And we can change the behavior of the animal, make them turn right or left. And we do all these activities in our special room, which is called Yellow Box. It's a clean room where we hack the traditional microfabrication tools and create evolving research needs, experiments, and devices. And Dina, maybe we can skip the next slide. And to do all these experiments, of course, I had a journey like the other amazing panelists on this panel. And I started my journey at Hacettepe University in Ankara, and I studied physics, even though many people thought physics is too difficult for a woman to study. But it was not the case, of course. And then I moved on for my master's degree at Sabancı University in Istanbul, and this time studied material science and engineering. And this is kind of a cartoon that I draw to show the importance of the materials. I knew the underlying mechanisms of the piezoelectricity and electronic devices, but then I also decided finding the best materials for the desired applications is also important. Like Newton had a pear on his head, but he didn't discover anything. But then the apple dropped on his head and bingo, he discovered the gravity. So it's the same thing. Like, we have to find the right materials by learning the materials science and engineering, and also finding a way how to manufacture them to make the sensors or actuators. And then in 2009, I came to USA as a Fulbright scholar and studied my PhD degree, working with John Rogers, and then moved to Harvard University. I was named as a junior fellow in the Society of Fellows at Harvard. And since then, I have been a junior fellow and also formed my own lab at MIT Media Lab. And Dina, the next slide, please. And in my group, we create implantable, wearable, attachable devices, which can be a part of your personal garments like underwear or bra or trousers. So we create a menu of devices for holistic healthcare interventions by bridging the gap between soft and dynamic body and hardened planar electronics. And I echo actually with Alvin and Dr. Andrea, they gave amazing suggestions for our participants, and maybe I'll follow up with that and say, just be yourself, be authentic, and do not lose your principles while having your journey, and don't be afraid to ask questions. Actually, we expand the world by asking the questions and finding the right resources and people to work with. And I would also say life is too short to follow someone else's dream. So follow your own dream, do whatever you want to do, but of course be profound and logical while you're taking your actions. And also I would say, don't postpone, always have a timeline so that it will keep you on track and have you to do things in a timely fashion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ben, for the very exciting slides. Our next speaker is Dr. Brian Flaw.
Hey everyone, it's an honor to be here. I've really enjoyed this workshop so far. I've learned a lot and been challenged and inspired. So my path to circuit design started at the University of Florida, where I went and earned all three degrees. And I was fortunate to work at a time when RF CMOS was still a new thing. And so doing my PhD, we were asking questions of how do you build circuits in CMOS, and how do you get them to work higher? And we did some interesting work related to trying to send chip signals around the chip using antennas and integrated transceivers. I then went to IBM Research up in Yorktown Heights and was really privileged to work at a really smart group of people with access to tremendous technology. And so there I was a research staff member, and we worked on millimeter wave integrated circuits at 60 gigahertz, doing some early radio demonstrations. I became a manager of a team where we then looked at phased arrays and how do you package them, and what the potential market opportunity could be. In 2010, though, I was able to return to my ultimate dream, which was to become a faculty member and a professor. So I'm here at NC State University. I teach classes in analog and RF and millimeter wave, and I'm leading a research team on radios and radars and imaging systems. What's kind of cool is that my mom is a teacher and my dad was an electronics technician. And so here I am kind of following in both of their footsteps, teaching electronics to the next generation. So next slide. So as I think about some of the things that helped grow my career, you know, one thing I thought was really fortunate was to participate in PhD research in what I call a lunatic fringe. And so we were trying to do wireless clock distribution up at 20 gigahertz in the late 90s when no one had even considered that as a potential path. And what I think that did is it taught me to try to think about problems in new ways, to persevere when things don't work. And research is hard, and there are going to be valleys of challenges and despairs that you have to work to overcome and persevere through. It also taught, you know, critical thinking and cross-domain. A second thing that really helped grow my career was taking an industry job prior to coming to the university. I think it's really important, at least for me, to learn what engineers do before then coming and trying to teach engineers. And as has been mentioned throughout today, mentorship was so important. I'm listing just a few of many mentors, and especially at IBM, they were been so critical to the things I learned along the way. Also, in the industry path, of course, it was really fun to be doing some new things. And for me, it was really important to get exposed to research and publication and funding at IBM. Third is just to make a really strong plug for volunteering with IEEE. And so for me, I've been involved in both journals and conferences. The main conference I've participated in is the IEEE RFIC Symposium. Last year, I was general chair, and I've had a number of different roles. But because networking is so important, and you all realize this because you're in this networking community, but IEEE is really valuable in forming those relationships. Also, it's a way to give back, and it's a way to learn and push yourself to grow. And so last slide. So there's a lot of different advice I could give, but I just summarized on a few different topics. In general, don't underestimate the need to communicate well and to get as much practice as you can, as early as you can, and continuously throughout your career. And this means both writing and speaking. A second is to work to understand your own mental health, what it means, and get help if and when needed. I see this more and more in graduate school. It's a difficult time, and resources are there, but you need to understand if and when you can go and seek those out. As far as research and graduate school, to me, it's really important that you understand the distinction between research and development. And I think sometimes students coming in and wanting to pursue graduate work in circuit design get too pulled into what I might call development activities, and make sure that you choose a research activity. Another thing is to write meaningful, impactful papers rather than just searching for the minimum publishable units. Third is really important, I think, in graduate school, is to take ownership of your own research as early as possible. You're not just a performer doing tasks for your advisor. it's your show. You're the lead character in that show. And so take ownership. Fourth, you've heard hearing this a lot, but diversify your network in graduate school and of course in the job. Don't cluster only in sameness. I think it's important to have community in which you can thrive and feel comfortable, but also you need diversity there. And finally on the job is to find good mentors. This has been already mentioned multiple times. And then finally, understand what motivates you and passionately pursue that. And so it's not the same for everyone, and that's fine. And it shouldn't be the same, but work to understand where you're going to get your satisfaction and impact from. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brian Floyd, and thanks to all the panelists for the slides. And now we will open the floor for questions from the audience. And the audience can enter the questions in the chat box until we start, and I will go through them through the Q&A document. So the first question from the audience, what is the best way to ask someone to be your mentor? And do you have any suggestions on how to get connected to mentors?
I've learned that the most valuable mentors to me are mentors that have evolved organically. We don't have a formal relationship per se. You just know, just when, you know, when you have questions, you know, never be afraid to ask questions, as has been iterated multiple times. And, I think one of the things that, I make a distinction between two types of questions, never a smart question versus a dumb question. My distinction is whether they're sincere or insincere. You ask sincere questions to people. If people want to help you, you will get help, and it builds from that, right? People have multiple. You know, what I found is that quite often, situations where people who are formally assigned to your mentor to be your mentor aren't necessarily going to do the best job because they're not necessarily very vested in doing it. It could be a checkbox that they need to fulfill in order to get promoted, because that's one checkbox that they've been lacking for obvious reasons. Organically having, who the approachable people are generally in the people you work with, and open up, generally, I have found that when I'm most vulnerable is when people understand me and are willing to help me. It's something not really formal. It's just, you can't just go to someone and say, please be my mentor. That's it. Now, along those lines, though, there is an SSES mentoring program that I want to give a pitch for. It's been great program. That's a great way to meet someone. Actually, one of my mentees is graduating from his PhD in University of Calgary, and he just left my place this morning. He stayed at my place. He wanted to come to San Diego, check it out. And I think he sold just on the weather. He wants to visit a few places he's interviewing at, but that can be a good program to meet people. But generally speaking, meeting mentors have been, at least very, very valuable lifelong mentors have been something that has evolved organically for me. Others perhaps.
Maybe may I just chime in? I definitely agree with Alvin. And one more thing that I would like to add is that usually when you look for a mentor, you know that there is something missing that you would like to fulfill, right? So when you look for a mentor, you need to study some people and understand who they are, what they do, and then approach them accordingly. If a person comes and asks for a mentorship blindly, it's never helpful. So it's always better to know. For instance, maybe I can give an example. When I was in Sabancı University, I came to MRS, Material Resource Society conference, by checking who are the audiences. And I really would like to do a PhD with John Rogers at that time. So I knew which session that he's going to attend and give a talk. And I also read a lot about his papers and find some amazing approaches in his devices. So when I approach him, I was like this, "Hi, Dr. Rogers, you are coming and giving a talk to this session. By the way, I'm also in that session. I'm going to give a talk. Maybe we can listen to each other's talk so that he can also know me. Not only I know him, He can also know me as a student, and I can go and ask him, by the way, all the devices that I have been doing in Turkey are bulky and rigid, but my dream is to make them flexible. And it looks like you have amazing flexible device approaches that I really would like to adapt and learn. Would you be my mentor? So, and he clicks right away because I studied him. He knows my passion, and he also knows that I'm looking, really looking for someone. So it's always better what is missing in you that you would like to fulfill, and then look for mentors accordingly.
Dr. Andrea, Dr. Brian, would you like to add any other comment?
To add in what was already said, you just cannot step into somebody say, hey, you will be my mentor. So, I mean, you have to establish, let's say, a human relationship. So I know it's very hard because normally this happens really very naturally when we meet each other in conferences, but these days we cannot meet, so I can understand it's a bit complicated. And I want to insist also on the mentoring program that was put in place by SSCS, which should be a replacement of that, but hopefully we will get soon all together in meeting places, in real meeting place.
Dr. Brian?
I think everyone's covered it well. I agree, the best ones happen organically in my experience.
So the next question is, how do you balance between having confidence in your work and being open to being wrong every once in a while and accepting criticism from others?
Okay, if you are a human, you will have some moments where you will be wrong and you have to admit it. So if you don't admit you are not wrong, this means you treat yourself as a humanoid, but you are not a humanoid. So everybody can be wrong, but you have to have the humility to admit you are wrong and to understand why you were wrong, and to take it as an opportunity to get better. So don't get stressed. You are allowed to be wrong, and the groups, the societies, whatever the organizations that don't admit you to be wrong, they are wrong, and they will lose the people and the quality of the people that they work with if they don't do it. So you can be wrong, but you have to admit it, to know it, and to learn about it, to learn from it, and that will make you always strong.
Any other panelists would like to add further comments?
Maybe I can real quick. Of course, it's better to be, you know, that the real success actually is to enjoy with your failures as well, like with your mistakes, so that you know how to be better in the things that you do. So I always think the human body in two halves. Like we have mistakes, we have successes on the other half. And if you're always successful and if you always know the things, you are actually the half person. Or if you're always bad and not doing something good and have failures and kind of the things are not going for your success, then you're again a half person. So balance in between is always helpful so that you have room to grow up and be better and enjoy yourself. It's always like, and we don't, for instance, run right away when we were born, right? We crawl, we learn, we fall down, and then we know how to start running and walking. So it's the same thing. It's better. And still right now, I receive criticism from my students. I do presentation to them and I ask them, what do they think? And oftentimes I have here and there some mistakes, and it's good. This is also a great dialogue between the parties to collaborate and to create something in harmony by having everyone's input inside. So failures or successes are both fine, I would say.
If I may add, there's a Confucian saying that says that one who knows is one who knows what he does not know, or one who knows what she does not know. Okay. And along these lines, one thing that has certainly helped me, you know, to actually, you know, embrace difficult, debates, technical debates and so forth, and walk out of it actually benefiting it from, as opposed to getting upset, is I've learned over the years is don't take yourself so seriously. I think when you do take yourself in a you know, in the gentler light, you find that getting to I don't know is okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, you've heard talk earlier about this imposter syndrome, and it's a real thing. My thinking is that a lot of people struggle with it. I struggle with it to this day. And so try not to let that prevent you from speaking up. Most people around you might be asking similar questions. So don't be afraid to talk.
Thank you very much. So the next question. How to know which career path is the right for example, fellowship track or managerial track in a corporate company? What are the reasons people take fellowship or managerial track?
If I may take a stab at it, at the end of the day, I think you just need to follow your heart. That's ultimately what it comes down to. What makes you happy, right? What gets you going? There's no right answer. I mean, Sujay had mentioned this before. I mean, you know, our you know, the panelists here have mentioned also. I mean, it's you know, we all have our own journey, and you know, the key is to learn from that journey. If you don't know if you're gonna like something or not, but you have an interest, you're curious about learning it something, then try it. If you don't like it, that's part of the learning, right? When you find out what you don't like, you basically can spend more time to do what you do like. So it's a very personal question.
I fully agree with Alvin. Yeah, just follow your heart. And also keep in mind that both in industry and in academia, these two paths, they are not parallel or divergent or whatever, they are interconnected, and you can change from one to another. Oh, okay, not every week, okay, but you can. I mean, it's not because now you take that path that you will stay on that path for all your career. It's just take a journey, and yeah, exactly as Alvin said, follow your heart. You know, in fact, and this answers also to Yildiz's question, when do you know if a new opportunity is the right one to take? Trust yourself. You have it in you. You have to, and listen to yourself.
Question, how do you get an internship, especially as an undergraduate?
So one thing on the subject of internships, I find that folks who you know, end up being very successful, at least from my own experiences, going through the front door of a company is typically not the easiest thing to get success. I mean, you know, there's so many resumes. The online system has definitely made it much easier for people to flood many companies with interest for internships. If you have connections through your parents, through your friends, colleagues, what have you, professors, don't be shy, right? I think the one thing, you know, just go and ask, express interest, and see if you can get your resume exposed to the right people. In a way, it took me a long time to learn this lesson, but one of the things you learn when you volunteer for all these IEEE activities, you're inviting people, you know, who are extremely famous, et cetera, et cetera. You learn to kind of put a little bit of shame away that it's okay. I wish my parents did not buy all the chocolates for me when I was a young kid, when I should be selling chocolates door to door and getting 90% rejections. I wish they didn't do that to me. But along those lines, you know, use your contacts, use your connections. If you don't have your own personal connections, you know, talk to your professors, you know, your parents' friends, etc., to you know, ask if they have interest. But you know, don't be afraid to get no as an answer. But you have to take the initiative, and that, to me, I think, is much more successful than sending your resumes to a pool and hoping that it will get recognized.
So the question again is, how do you get an internship, especially as an undergrad? Does ST, for example, Dr. Freya, offer a program for undergraduate students?
I mean, yeah, for sure we have that. So in France, they are like 2 months or 4 months. The format, it's maybe not the same as in the US, but yeah, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, we have also that impersonal internet stuff where you put 10 CVs. But I mean, if you have network, if you have friends of friends, and don't hesitate. Also, there is something that works very nicely. So all of you, so for the young undergraduate, you need to have your LinkedIn account working and put your CV there and say, I am looking for an internship here and there. And you add hashtags, you know, that the engine work with hashtag words, and you put an hashtag like electrical engineering, I don't know, analog, digital design, whatever, and send it's not a bottle in the sea, it's a bottle in our internal sea. It's like, you know, the Mediterranean is the internal, it was seen like a lake. So it's our world. Don't hesitate to do that and to ask friends, colleagues, professors to rely your message. So people who have a bit larger network than you to rely your message. That can be very, very helpful. And for example, myself, whenever I see a CV like that, I don't know the person, even if it's a field connects to mine, I relay it as well. So that works nicely also.
Okay, Dr. Brian and Dr. Jenan, so a question like, the US, like faculty members, typically focus on training PhD students. Are there opportunities for undergraduates to prefer to admit them for an internship through a structured program in the university? MIT, for example, had the Super Europe program. Or you can.
So as you said, MIT has an undergraduate program, and last 4 years since I joined MIT, I advised 32 undergraduate with a significant female contribution. And these students write at least a paper in my group. I know very well the statistics because last Monday I did my promotion talk. So I prepared a slide on this. So it was like very clear to me what I have done last 4 years. And in terms of other undergraduates externally, like from not from MIT, MIT also has a different program called MSRP. They have minority students from different backgrounds, and externally they come. I think they select like 30 or 35 students every year, and I'm accepting one of the students this summer to my group. This is my first year to join to that summer program, and they spend more than 2 months, and they become a part of our research and learn what we do, and we give proper trainings to them so that we're experimental, so that they know how to do experiment, how to design an experiment, how to change the variables and so forth. But usually when an undergrad works with us, they often spend more than a semester so that they can build up what they have learned and get proper credit at the end of their work in my group. And I always find it very helpful, both for the faculty as well as for the student, because students kind of understand if the person is into the research or not and sort of shape the future accordingly. For faculty, it's also good, because they invest some time on student, and if it works out, then you have a very well-trained graduate student in your group after a year. So it's always better to do internships and rotations among different groups so that you can really find your own way and know what you want to do.
Thank you, Dr. Brian. Do you rely on undergraduate students in asking them?
Yeah, so I have some, but not a ton of undergrads in my group. But in my department, there's quite a few undergraduate researchers, and sometimes the best ways is you start with the faculty that you're studying under and ask about the research opportunities within their group. And that's how you kind of begin to branch out to figure out the opportunities that are there. One other program that exists is called Research Experience for Undergraduates, REU. In the U.S., it's a National Science Foundation program that a number of faculty have funds to support that, typically in a summer time frame.
And do you welcome international students as well? Like, I know SF is typically like welcome like emails of international students who like to get sponsored for summer.
So these research experiences. can be from international. So I had one come from Germany, work during the summer in my group, and it was a tremendous experience. He contributed a lot. There's published papers as a result. So it's really good.
Thank you very much. So the next question is, how do you recognize your passion? What is in your heart, for instance? How do you have enough confidence? What particular research or job you should choose? So many graduate students and even new designers like might not be sure which project they start on. They be eager on success quickly, but they are not sure which track to follow. So one of the audience is asking, like, how do you recognize the right project?
I may dare say, I think there's an element of foolishness to this, right? I mean, you just, you know, have to follow your heart. And I mean, you know, and sometimes not be totally logical about it. I just played like the game of life with my daughter, and she's figured out that the best way to win is to not go to college and to not have kids. But if we were to have that kind of logic, we would just be destroyed or decimated as a human race. But follow your passion.
I would say, so you guys who are really graduating these days, you are really lucky, because the semiconductor industry wants you, and there are 10 times more open positions than what we have as engineers graduating these days. So there is job everywhere. And like Alvin says, follow your heart. And if you really don't know what you want to do, and this answers also to the second question, is should I stay narrow, but very expert, or very broad? So go see a friend and choose one topic and talk to your friend about that topic. And if you talk with your heart, that's your topic. Okay, and so that's it. And the question between being very narrow but very, very expert, or wide, and so it's the same. But to that one, there are people who like to do one thing at a time, and there are people who like to do many things at a time, and this will also maybe put you into being more narrow and or being more wide angle. But I tell you, these days you just go out on the street and you find 10 jobs at the hour. Alvin says the same. So just go.
Brian?
Maybe, yeah, don't overthink it though. I mean, there are so many ways to make an impact with your work. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, we're just curious in trying new things. And so, you know, that curiosity sometimes can just lead you into these areas, and then you discover this whole new country unexplored, and you know, it sounds trite, but there's so much room to make an impact that don't overthink like you're going to make a wrong choice. You know, you're going to make a choice and you're going to pursue it and succeed there. And that's maybe it's not super clear advice, but for me, I think I can overanalyze my decisions, and it keeps me on the sidelines sometimes when I should just jump in.
Dr. Jenna?
I agree with all advices. And one thing that I would add, we are all different. And once in a while, I think it's better to pause and imagine yourself in 5 to 10 years. Where do you want to see yourself? What do you want to do? And this kind of questions, of course, not easy to answer right away. But it's also related how much you read and meet with others and understand what others are doing, what are the gaps that you would like to fulfill, and how you would like to show your impact to the society. It's very subjective, and there is no clear equation. But one thing that I would certainly suggest, at least be very good at in one or two things. So one, be wanted in those fields or areas. And the rest, you can just, you know, flavor it with other things, other disciplines or skills or backgrounds. But be better in one thing so that people will say, oh, this person is really good at designing piezoelectric integrated circuit. But at the same time, he or she can add this kind of things to make the device different than others. Also, one thing that I find helpful is to show how singular you are, how your things are different than others, to show your kind of, how to say, how authentic you are, how your devices or work is different than others, always puts you in a great position. And most of the time, people also feel excited to work with you, collaborate with you, talk to you. And one more thing that I would suggest, given that it's now a COVID time, it's hard to meet with people in person, to just watch the TED Talks or watch talks over YouTube. And we live in a global world. It's always easy to send a message within a second, like to any people all around the world. If they don't answer, send an email another week. At the end, somebody will certainly answer you and you will find a connection. So now I would say the life is much easier in terms of connections.
Thank you very much. So the next question, as part of it, having knowledge in just one field and having a broad knowledge in different fields, which one increases the success rate? Like just focusing on IC design in one or blocks, or focus on a whole system level designs more than IC design? Dr. Brian of Saiton.
I mean, to me, this is the age-old question of depth versus breadth. And, you know, I think it's a balance of the two. When I advise students asking about taking classes, I tell them, you know, you want to be an expert and really good at an area, but you also want to make sure you take classes, what I call one level above and one level below. So think, who are you a customer of? And who are your customers, and get learning in those areas. And so in circuits, we're a customer of technology, so you need to learn semiconductors. And then, you know, for me, my customers are wireless, and so I want to understand that. And so, you know, that's how I think of the depth versus the breadth in terms of taking classes. And
thank you very much. We are actually out of time. Are generous with us with your advice, and we have been very fortunate to get your advice today. And thanks very much for Alice and Nicholas for inviting me to the committee session. And we hope that you also enjoyed the discussions with the audience today through the chat box. And back to Alice and Nicholas.
So, yeah, I'd like to just wrap up and close this session. First of all, just want to thank all the students who applied and attended, and we hope that you were inspired by just seeing how big this community is, how big the opportunity is in IC design. And there are so many great mentors for you out in this community, and we want to support you. And to just acknowledge the speakers and the panelists for spending this Sunday morning with us, sharing your wise advice, really valuable for all of us to learn. And we'd like to thank the committee. We've been meeting weekly since April to put together this program, and especially thank Abira for all her support on the IEEE staff, and Yildiz as the workshop chair for all her hard work, and all the committee members. We really enjoy working together and being part of the Women in Circuits community, which all of you are welcome to join. We love to have diversity. And in particular, as you've heard before, only 5% of our society are female, so it can be quite lonely. But once we started this community, we are surrounded by supportive, capable women leaders all around the world. So just want to appreciate and thank this community, and to close this session, and hope that you will join us at SSCS events and join us to be part of this community. Thank you.